I'm Alvin, I'm an addict. Woo-wee. I have been to so many of these conventions, and I've been to so many of these Friday nights, and I've stood out there, and I've looked up there, and I said, man, how do you get up there? How do you become the person that they asked to speak and share their experience, strength, and hope? And I'll tell you how you do that if you're new. You just stay clean today. I'd like to thank the CMP region and the host committee for asking me to share, to helping me with my recovery, particularly the program committee. They've done an awesome job. Let's give everybody a hand who's helped put this convention together. It's not an easy job to put a convention together. I've been on at least four of the regional conventions, served on an area convention with East of the River, and there's a lot of commitment and time that goes into putting these things on. You make ultimate sacrifices to put on these conventions. You have to give up a little American Idol to put on these conventions. So before you take a and shoot your opinion about what might have been done differently, think about that, okay? I'd like to share a little bit about a couple of people who didn't make it to this convention. There were a couple of guys who were here last year who didn't make it, and I wanted to acknowledge them. One by the name of Jim G, who was on the BOD, he passed away, and they just had his funeral on Monday. And a lot of people who knew Big Jim, and I just want to say God bless him. And the other fella, his name is Ray Burgess. Ray had been to 22 conventions, and his clean date is February 14th, 1987. And Ray died this year. So why don't we just have a moment of silence, not just for them, but for anybody who didn't make it, whether they couldn't make it because they died, whether they couldn't make it because of money, whether they couldn't make it because they didn't stay clean. Can we just have a moment of silence for those who didn't make it this year? Thank you. You know, I'm really excited about my recovery today. It started out not one of the best days. You know, I wanted to get down here early so I wouldn't have so much time to focus on standing in front of all of you and get down and be a part of the hug squad and be in service. I had a great plan how I was going to spend my Friday at CNP Region, but it didn't work out like that. First off, my wife decided that she had to go and get a surgical procedure on her eyes. Now, grant you, you know, when a person gets something done on their eyes, it's a very important medical procedure. But the little man on my shoulder was saying, she's holding up us from getting to the convention. Now, mind you, my clean date is May 9th, 1986. Right. And May 9th, I'll have 23 years clean. All of that went out the window when she started messing with my plans. Right. So I'm just waiting, and then she says, "Okay, let's go to the bank. I have to go to the bank. I have all this money. I don't want to bring it. I don't want to take it down to the convention." I said, "Well, was the bank closed yesterday?" Anyhow, and then we were on our way. I'm like, it's 9 o'clock. I'm getting ready to go out Kenilworth Avenue, hit Route 50, get here, cross the Bay Bridge, be in Ocean City, get the plane going, and we get a phone call from people who are towing our car because I'm going to be leaving the area after the Sunday day meeting, and I'll be moving to Louisiana to be with my grandchildren and my daughter. Thank you. My daughter's going to Afghanistan, and I'm going to be helping take care of the four grandbabies. Thank you very much. And I can I can only you know, do the things like that, you know, because of Narcotics Anonymous and what you people have taught me and the principles that you have placed in my life and in my heart. Okay, back to the story. So, you know, so we're trying to get all this stuff towed down there. And, you know, to make a long story short, the guy called us saying, you know, instead of picking up my car on Monday or Tuesday to tow it, that he would be bringing it, you know, he'd be coming down and he would be towing it at 12 o'clock. So now I'm really, man, all the spiritual Al just went right out the window then. So it, you know, nonetheless, we left D.C. about 2 o'clock, got here about 5. Yeah, I got here about 5 o'clock. I've never gotten out here later than 12 o'clock. So, you know, I guess what I'm learning, what my sponsor tells me and what my friends tell me is that, you know, you get to make the plans, you just don't get to plan the results. You know, so, but I made it down here. I'm going to read two things from our NA approved literature, and that'll be about the total amount of stuff that I read. And this is from the Just for Today. And I remember when I read this in the Just for Today, it's November the 12th. And it says, our own story. When we honestly tell our story, someone else may identify with us. Basic Text, page 95. Many of us have heard truly captivating speakers at Narcotics Anonymous conventions. We remember the audience alternating between tears of identification and joyous hilarity. Someday, we may think, I'm going to be a main speaker at a convention too. Well, for many of us, that day has yet to arrive. Speak for yourself. Once in a while, we may be asked to speak at a meeting near where we live. We may speak at a small convention workshop, but after all, this time, we're still not hot convention speakers, and that's okay. We learn that we too have a special message to share, even if it's only at a local meeting with 15 or 20 addicts in attendance. Each of us has our own story to tell, and that's it. We can't tell anyone else's story. Every time we get up to speak, many of us find all the clever lines and funny stories seem to disappear from our minds. Yeah, they have. But we do have something to offer. We carry the message of hope. And we can and do recover from our addiction. And that's enough. Just for today, I will remember that my honest story is what I share the best. Today, that's enough. And that's what I'm going to share tonight, ladies and gentlemen, my honest story. And hope that that is enough for you. I was thinking earlier today, where do I begin? And I guess I could begin in grade school, you know, finally realizing that there was something different about me. I have a twin brother. He's out here somewhere. And, you know, if you see him later on, you know, he'll have a name badge on that says Albert. But I'm not here to tell his story, but our stories are so intertwined. You know, in grade school, I can remember being in the cloakroom with a little girl. It doesn't get worse than that, guys. And the young lady asked me, she said, Alvin, if you show me yours, I'll show you mine. Well, I showed her mine, and she didn't show me hers. I believe from that day on, I had trust issues. I don't know who she is, whether it's Becky or Betty or Sarah or Jane, but if you're in this meeting tonight, you owe me an amends. You owe me an amends. And it's incidents like that, you know, even as a child, that let me know that I was different, that there was something about me that, you know, that's not what you do, Alvin. You know, I can remember as a little boy going to vacation Bible school and getting the money out of the tray downstairs in the basement. You know, even as kids, my brother and I, we were very smart boys. you know, bright, and the teachers would say things like, you know, they're going to be successful children. They're going to be, you know, the kind of kids that parents would be proud of, you know. And then, you know, after about the first semester, saying, well, but they can't stay in the same room. And that's how it went. You know, we would be able to stay in the same room or stay in the same school for maybe an advisory. And then they would switch us around and they would change us. You know, and it was like a pattern, you know, like a behavior pattern. As I grew older, that pattern continued. My grades started to drop. You know, I started hanging out with people that weren't interested in school, weren't interested in some of the things that I grew up to be interested in, because, you know, this was not my goal. My goal, you know, even though I read this and being a main speaker is, you know, is such a wonderful, wonderful honor. This is not my goal in life. I didn't plan to be in front of 5,000 drug addicts sharing about pulling my pants down in kindergarten. That's not what I started out to do. I can remember as a kid reading stories and reading books and, you know, about, you know, being an FBI agent or being in the Secret Service, or, you know, things like that, you know, rescuing people, you know, being a hero, you know. I still today have to be careful there because I suffer from a hero syndrome that I want to save you. You know, I want to ride on some kind of horse and, you know, pick you up like you see in one of the cowboys. And, you know, at the end, you know, the credits would roll and my name would be on there. Yes, I lived in fantasy. I lived in a world of fantasy, you know. And so that's what my life was. It's like, okay, these are the things I read, you know. My heroes growing up were James Bond, John Wayne, and Shaft. Because they always seemed to rescue somebody, you know. So at some point in time, I started hanging out with guys, man, you know, who told me, Alvin, you got to put those things away. You know, instead of reading books about James Bond, you know, I started reading books like the autobiography of Malcolm X. You know, instead of reading, you know, the story of the Secret Service as a kid, I was reading Man, Child, and the Promised Land. You know, and I made a shift, you know, and what I was thinking and who I was hanging out with, you know, and those people started to become my life, you know. I don't exactly remember when I started using. I just know that, you know, one day I was at a club somewhere in some part of the town chasing Chuck Brown. Yeah, man, Chuck done sent a whole lot of us up in here. Chuck in the room, y'all, you know. Come on now, you know. And chasing Chuck Brown, and, you know, I was getting my party on, you know, and I kept noticing guys going into a bathroom, and they would come out, you know, going to the bathroom, they would come out, they were the kind of guys that I wanted to be like. They would slick, hip, and cool, and they dressed real nice. And I remember going into that bathroom and taking a hit of something. And when the smoke cleared, you know, I was at Carrick Hall Detox. It was 1986. And I took that puff, must have been somewhere in the 70s. And the rest, it was almost like a blur. It was almost like, you know, where did my life go? You know, what happened? I wound up getting jobs, losing jobs, getting wives, losing girlfriends, you know. But I couldn't put the two together. I couldn't put the fact that maybe, you know, Alvin, it's the drugs. You know? You know, I remember, you know, people telling me when I would tell them things like, man, you know, I have a drug problem. You know, I think I have a drug problem. They say, oh, nah, man. You know, just take something else.
Take that.
I later found out what they were saying, that that's like changing seats on the Titanic. But I said, no, man, you know, if you got a dope habit, take this. You got a coke habit, take that. You know, stop smoking weed. You know, gain weight. You know, all kinds of people were giving me all kinds of good advice. But you know what? They could never give me the advice that could help me stop. You know, I could never stay stopped. You know, I could always stop for a little while. You know, I'd go, you know, to a Bible class, or, you know, I'd promise my wife I would stop, or, you know, I'd get into a business. I remember one time I got into the Amway business. I stopped for one whole year. You know, so it was always, you know, something that could help me stay stopped. But only till I came to Narcotics Anonymous could I actually stay stopped one day at a time. And when I look back on those days, you know, there were times, you know, when there were a lot of people in my life that I ran away. A big part of my story is that if you dared to love me, you became my next victim. You know, and that's the kind of addict that I was. I was a getting in the way kind of addict. You know, if you pull my jacket, you know, downtown at the police department, you'll see charges like petty larceny, obstruction of justice, and failure to pay bus fare. That's the kind of guy I am, man. You know, not thug life and, you know, 15 prisons, that's not who I am. You know, I'm a guy that could work and use. I'm a guy who got a college degree while he was using. As a matter of fact, I almost forgot that. You know, April the 2nd, I just retired from my job. This is the watch they gave me. You know, I worked 30 years for the U.S. government. Yeah. You know, using addicts don't do that. You know. If I hadn't found this program, I wouldn't have been able to do that. You know, getting back on track here. Yeah, so that's the kind of the person that I am, man. I don't do anything positive, you know, for an extended period of time when I'm using. You know, and I can remember back in the 60s when I thought that, you know, that my life would be a successful life, when I would, you know, get the things that, you know, I thought I would be, but something happened, you know, something happened when I took that first puff. I can remember hanging out with people like the Black Panther Party or on one weekend. You know, this is back in the 60s. I know I'm dating myself for some of you. You know, back during the days when we had our real protest for the war, the Vietnam War. Back in the days when, you know, on any street corner, you would have any number of people who would be talking, you know, philosophy and, you know, talking about politics. You know, I wanted to be a part of that. I wanted to fight the man, you know. I wanted to be a real soul brother, you know. Matter of fact, I opened up a checking account when I was 19 years old, and I put on my checks, Brother Alvin Elliott, right? Because I wanted to be a real brother, you know what I mean? But what happened is, you know, drugs robbed me of all my dreams and ambitions. You know, there was no movement to be a part of. I'll get to it later. Call me when the revolution's over, brother. You know, and that's what happened, man. You know, I wish that I had done more things, but you know, what I've come to understand by being in this process and getting to know me, man, that I am in the right place at the right time right now. And anything that I didn't get or I didn't have today, you know, I can't worry about it because that's yesterday's news. You know, you people teach me that, you know, it's a just for today program, and that's where I have to stay. Just in today. At the end, you know, the bottom was horrific for me, you know. You know, my wife, I used to say my wife left me, but I realize now that she escaped. You're in a house with a used and attic, man. You just need to get out, right? So she escaped. She took my son with her. And, you know, I was, you know, home alone. You know, and I was like, good, I get more using time. And I did what, you know, any decent family-oriented man who loved his wife and children would do if they left. I threw a party. And my brother Albert helped me. So I threw the party and, you know, we in there jamming, getting our robot on. I ain't thinking about her. She shouldn't have left. What's your name, baby girl? You know. But you know, the thing that I've come to find out is, no matter how much dope you use, you cannot use enough dope to cover up all the pain. And that man, you know, the reality is that I was hurting. Because I started to see it crumble. They came and set out, I had a little townhouse down in Southwest. They came and set all my furniture out on the ground. I can remember my other brother calling me, he said, man, they having a lawn sale out in front of your house with all your furniture. and even today, every time I ride by a place where they've set people out, one of the things I said, but for the grace, there go I. So I know that feeling, man, to have your stuff set out, So I went to live with my mom, I'm my mama's boy. And, I used to tell people when I used to get a date, I would say, well, they'd say, well, where do you live? I said, well, I'm divorced. I'm getting divorced, so I'm living with my mother, The reality is, I had gotten set out and I was living with my mother. And I paid my mother back. And I was really grateful for living with my mother, because what I did, I stole out of her purse. I was one of those kind of addicts, and I'm not proud of it. I'm just sharing it as part of my story for anybody who might be able to identify with that, and those feelings of guilt and shame and remorse that you have when you take from someone who's always given. My mother was always giving to me. My mother would always, wherever I was, whether I was in treatment, but I was locked. The few times that I was locked up, I remember when I first got the job with the government, she got me the application. She was, always there for me, and I paid her back by stealing out her purse. I would tell her stuff like, say, Mom, how come you keep losing your purse? Let me help you find it. And it's funny today, but back then, man, that was another time when I had to use, man, to mask the pain, and the shame, of not being a man. I was 33 years old. I was sleeping on my mother's couch. I was a bum, but I'm not that same person today. At the end, it was, I was living to use and using to live, I would do things like I'd get paid on Friday, and all I'd have on Saturday morning was the bus transfer. And I would do that time and time again. I would tell myself, Alvin, what you needed to do was go in and get one and then come out. Yeah, that worked. I would even have people, and usually when you're in a dope joint, man, the people there don't even have any scruples. They just spend all your money. They would tell me shit like, man, why don't you leave? Go ahead, man. Twin, go on home. And what I would do is that, on Friday I would get paid and I would put money in different envelopes and I would write on there rent, transportation, food, child support, And at the end of the night, all the envelopes would be busted and laying on the ground. I'd have that mouth look. I'd be reaching in my sock, taking my shoe off. I ain't putting nothing into my sock. You know, just, you know, in the grip. In the grip. Caught up in the grip, man, you know, of this disease, man. Caught up in the grip, man, you know. No way out. You know, I could see no way out. You know, and, you know, that's at the end. You know, at the end, you know, I would be in the shower, man. I'd be showering. I'd be crying in the shower, man. You know, why me? Why am I the only one that can't use safely? Ah, but I see I was not, huh? Yeah. So I'm not alone, huh? Yeah, all right. So, you know, I realized at the time, man, I just thought I was all alone and there was no out for me. And so I did, you know, what every addict would do. You know, it started going to a series of, making a series of mea culpas. You know, I'd plead to people, oh yeah, I got a drug problem, let me get into a program. And, you know, I'd get into a number of little programs. I remember I went to one program and the guy, and I had somebody else's urine, right? So he, that was before they had the little strips on there where you can take the temperature, right? And, you know, he said, man, this urine is cold. I said, well, stick your finger in it, man. It might not be warm. You know, just pretending, man, that, you know, that I wanted to, you know, wanting to stop, but not knowing how. I don't want to say I was pretending. Wanting to stop, but not knowing how, you know. I wanted to stop long before I actually did stop. I just didn't know how. I didn't know there was rooms like this. I didn't know there was a Narcotics Anonymous available to help an addict like me stop using a day at a time. You know. So my last night of active addiction, kind of the last couple of days, you know, I was with this guy. I hadn't been to work for about 2 weeks, a month. I was out with this guy. Now, I told you what kind of charges I got, right? Petty larceny, failure to pay bus fare, that kind of stuff. So I'm hanging out with this guy who's a real cannon. For those who don't know, he's a real good pickpocket, right? So all I have to do is be with him, and he's going to take the wallet, and I'll get the money, right? We'll get the money. We'll split it, right? Well, we were rolling around for the better part of about 5 or 6 hours, and he realized what the problem was. It was me. He realized that if he continued to hang out with me, that he was going to be as broke as I was. So he abandoned me about 7 o'clock, you know, and I remember this as if it were yesterday. And so I'm down there at DuPont Circle, and, you know, I see this woman. I said, well, you know, what I'll do is I'll snatch her purse. And once I snatch her purse, you know, I'll have me some money and I'll get high. And I know that's the grace of God. Because I know, I believe, that if I had gotten high that night, I wouldn't be here today. So when she was walking by, I reached out and I snatched the purse, and the strap broke. And it fell and hit the ground. And she screamed and ran one way, and I screamed and ran the other way, and the purse just laid there. And I ran for all of about a block, as fast as I could. Been on drugs for the last 18 years. So after about a block, it seemed like a marathon to me. I said the dope fiend prayer. I said, God help me. God help me. And at the time, my brother was in the program, and I jumped in a cab. I need to make amends to them too. I ain't had no money. I jumped out the cab, and he was screaming something at me. And I was like, okay. I just needed to get to where I needed to get to, right? And he got me into a detox and into a treatment program. And this is not an endorsement of treatment. This is just my story. Because I've seen addicts since I've been here come into this program, get clean, and stay clean. So if you're sitting out there thinking that, man, I need to go to a couple more programs to get to this program, no, you do not. You can stay clean right here today. So now, I started coming to meetings, you know, and got out in May of 1986, started coming to meetings, and I went to meetings, and I went to meetings, and I went to meetings. I think the Just for Today today talks about priority meetings. Yeah, priority meetings. I read the Just for Today every day. Priority meetings, you know. They told me meeting makers make it. You know, we had some tough... That's right. We had some tough guys and gals that were in the fellowship when I got here, you know. And to show you how tough they got, these people were staying clean. I got the Narcotics Anonymous 86. I think our basic text was written in 82. And there were people who had gotten here before I had gotten here, and they were staying clean without the basic text. And I find that to be so powerful today, not to have a book, but to believe. And I believed because they believed. You know, they were very therapeutic at that time. You know, the loving and caring part. They hadn't gotten totally grasping, you know. And they would say stuff like, sit down and shut up. We want to find out how to use, we'll ask you. And they were a tough little crew there, man. And a lot of them had come through other therapeutic communities. So they would do stuff like give you a haircut in the meeting. You know, if you said something crazy, you know, thanks for letting me share. They spend the next 2 or 3 minutes ripping you a new asshole. And then they would take you out to eat. Yeah, they'd take you out to eat. And they gave me rides, and they helped me out, you know. And I'm forever grateful for them. I stand on their shoulders tonight. I stand on the shoulders of the Carmelitas, you know, and the Doreens, and the pioneers. I mean, I understand there are no big eyes or little U's in this program, you know, and I don't mean to put them on a pedestal, but they are my predecessors. There are the people that opened the door for me so that addicts like this can stay clean. When they got clean, you know, you would probably have half of that section over there in Narcotics Anonymous. But you know, they stayed because they believed. There was no evidence. The only evidence were the addicts in that room. You know, today there's more evidence than enough. There's more literature. My God. You know, it works how and why. The flat books, sponsorship books, you know, new IPs coming out every day. We have more literature today. I'm not an advocate of the phrase that, you know, when I got here was better, or, you know, I'm a believer, and if you're in Narcotics Anonymous today is the best day for you to get clean, right here, right now. You know, and so we started to get clean. It was a bunch of us, you know, some of us, the class of 86, that's what we call ourselves. We had about 22 years, a lot of us still clean today. And, you know, I remember I had a hoopty. It was a Torino, a green Torino with no floorboards. And we would get in there and we'd put up, you know, I'd look in the back, I said, man, everybody in the back, all right? And they had their feet up on it like the Flintstone car. We'd be going to the meeting, you know, but everybody that was in that car is clean today. Everybody down in that car is clean today. Meeting makers make it. Meeting makers make it. You know, a lot of stuff, you know, working the program, you know, working the steps, having a sponsor, you know, being in service. Those are the cornerstones, you know, of my recovery. Those were the things that, you know, planted my feet so that I would not waver, you know, when a storm comes. What Doreen said, used to rock when the storm comes, you know. And for me, I believe in that. And that's what I share with anybody who comes into this program. You know, back then when I came in, you know, I didn't see myself having all the things or having the success or, you know, having the level of consciousness that I have today. You know, back when I got clean, I wanted to do two things. I wanted to go to the Uptown on Saturday night with a pair of pants that had a crease in it. Because the Uptown was the big meeting that we went to over on 12 and S in D.C., right? And the other thing that I wanted to do, I wanted to get the Pathfinders on 12 and H so we could party. How many Pathfinders folks out there, huh? That was, that was like a little hole in the wall place. When I look back at that place, I said, oh my God, I went up there almost every Saturday just to dance. You know, we would dance ourselves into a sweaty frenzy. And then we'd go home or try to get lucky. Most days I just went home. But I got lucky every once in a while. Let me stop lying. And my recovery, started to work. The program was working in my life. I became, a parent again. I became a father again. I didn't become a husband again. I didn't do that for a while anyway. I became, an uncle and a brother again. I became the president of my son's PTA, And that's the kind of stuff that was going on in my life. I had gotten busy, and then I hit that little place in recovery, though, that we call complacency. Some of you can identify, with that complacency mode. I started doing what we call drive-by recovery. You know what drive-by recovery is? Yeah. Some of you have made it here today and haven't been to a meeting all year. That's drive-by recovery. When you know there's a big anniversary and you kind of make sure that you show by, that's drive-by recovery. I'm talking my experience now. I'm not talking about you. If the shoe fit, you know what to do with it. That's drive-by recovery. When you don't celebrate your anniversary, when you don't have a home group, when you don't have a sponsor, that's drive-by recovery. Yeah, you're just driving by the meeting because your car is clean. Or you got a new suit on. Drive-by recovery. And I had gotten caught up in money, property, and prestige. I was living out in Columbia, Maryland, nice little townhouse out there, Like George Jefferson says, I was moving on up. Moving on up, right? I was a supervisor at my job, so, every day I'd come into work. They would say, Mr. Albin, how you doing today, sir? I said, I'm fine. Thank you for asking. See, no longer was I in the crack house. I was in the White House. So, I started moving further and further away from recovery. I got a second job. You know how you are when you've been here a while, you think that, well, if I get a second job, then I could get more recovery. No, second job doesn't mean more recovery. So I got a second job. And I said, well, if I work this second job, what I wanted to do is I wanted to get about $10,000 to take care of all my bills. Never happened. and instead of, saying prayers and, meditating and having quiet time, the only prayer I would say was, Lord, let the clock ring so that I can get to the second job. And I was working 60, 70, 80 hours a week. Not every 2 weeks. And they told me my spiritual condition started to fade. So what do you do when your spiritual condition starts to fade? You move somebody in to make you feel good about yourself. You start looking for love in all the wrong places. So I moved in this recovering person who wasn't recovering anymore. That's a nice way of saying she was drinking. And at the beginning, it was like, it's no problem. Go ahead. That's what you're doing. I'm staying clean. And then she called me one day. She says, look, could you stop by and pick up 12 Miller Gold on the way home, brother? I'll be here waiting for you. So, you know, the big head started, you know, being led by the little head. So I brought him home. And then she said, you know, one night after she had finished me off, she said, would you go down there and get me one? So once again, the little head, I surrendered to the little head. I went down there and got her one and poured it in. So it became a habit of me pouring them for her. And then one day, you know, it started not to work. The relationship started to turn sour. It's kind of hard when you come home and go and try to get into your bed and you smell alcohol every night and you're supposed to be in recovery and you're not using. The last time we actually had a conversation together was over some, we had an argument over some meaningless thing that was going on in the house. But all I could see was she was standing in the door sill of the kitchen and she had the Miller Lite and the big can in her hand and she was just all over the place. But I was fixated on that because she did not spill a drop. And it was like one of those slow motion movies. Didn't spill a drop, not one. Oh, you know, and I knew it was the end. I went to the meeting. I went to the Uptown meeting first, and I remember sitting in the meeting. And one of my predecessors, Joan H., she asked me, she said, man, we are celebrating. She said, I know you got 12 years coming up. I said, Joan, I don't have a home group. I'm not celebrating. And she reached in her purse and she gave me her 12-year medallion. And, I knew that was just God's working in my life. And she, you know, she gave it to me, and I went to the Conscious Contact Group. I met up with another addict up there, and I shared that, I was living with a person that was drinking, and I wasn't happy about it, and I just needed to do something different. You know, that I wasn't using a sponsor, that I didn't have a home group at the time. And I remember this guy, you know, didn't know him from Adam. He walked up to me and he said, man, I know how it feels to be with a using addict. And the light bulb went off. I was living with a using addict. At the time, I just thought, well, shit, you know, she can drink if she wants to. But the reality is, I was living with a using addict. You know, she left. You know, because I stopped justifying and rationalizing the most outrageous nonsense. You know, and she moved on. You know, I found a home group, the Recovery Alley Group of Washington, D.C. And I've been there ever since. I got back in service. I got me a sponsor. Not in name, but that I use and that I call. You know, I started going to meetings like I did when I first got clean. And I have been going to meetings like that ever since. You know, my recovery today is the best that it's ever been. You know, I live a life, man, of abundance. You know, if I sit up here, I could talk for hours about, you know, how good, you know, my God and my understanding has been to me. When I came into Narcotics Anonymous, I did not have a relationship with God. Matter of fact, the only prayer I knew when I came into Narcotics Anonymous was the same prayer I knew as a child. Now lay me down to sleep. I pray the Lord my soul to keep. If I should die before I wake, to pray the Lord my soul to take. I had a relationship with God that was a relationship that an 8-year-old boy would have. But I was a 33-year-old man. And you people, you know, told me about the relationship you had with God. I was a little reluctant at first, you know, because I thought you were scary. There was a guy who used to come into meetings all the time, Thomas W. He would always say, "Thank God for you." He would scare me. He was a big old guy, man. He said, "Man, thank God for you." And give you one of those hugs. And I would look at him. And then the next time I went to the meeting, I would be on the other side of the room. But what I've come to understand, man, that, you know, most people are afraid of something they don't have a relationship with. And if I didn't have one of the reasons that I was afraid of having a person who had a God in his life is because I didn't have one in my life. And that's what our second step talks about. Most of us do not have a relationship with him. You know, I believe my higher power was there for me all the time. You know, I was just not willing, you know, to establish that relationship. Today I understand that my relationship with my higher power is the most important thing that I have in my life. One of my predecessors always talks about keeping the appointment, you know, with that 11th step, keeping the appointment. He always says that God is waiting for you. Will you keep the appointment out? And that's what I do on a daily basis. Not regularly, daily. I keep the appointment with the God of my understanding. You know, I pray, and I pray for me. I pray for others, you know, that they can have the things that I can have. I'm not the perfect addict, trust me. Just the other day I was out with a friend having dinner. You know, a lot of people have been taking me out to eat since I've been, you know, I've made the decision to transition out of this area down to Louisiana. And so the character defect of greed has kicked in. So every time somebody says eat, I say, "Let's go." And so I brought two suits down here, right? One was the little Luther suit and one was the big one, right? This is the big suit. My brother and I said, we have what you call clothes when we gain a little weight and when we lose a little weight. You know, remember how Luther Vandross used to have, you know, he'd lose a little weight and then he'd have a new suit, right? So anyway. You know, I'm going into the Verizon Center around back off 6th Street and this guy bumps into me. It's like, you know, walks through me. So I turn around to see, what's his problem? So I walk a few more steps away, and he mumbles something. I turn around, I said, "Oh my God, he's talking to me." So now I get to almost away, and the person who I'm with says, "Listen, Alvin, come on, don't, just come on." So I go back to, no, the little voice who's been kicked into high gear by the cup of Starbucks coffee I had. That stuff is a drug. Okay? You get some Starbucks in it, your ears start ringing, you know? So the Starbucks start talking to me and saying, you know, "Who do he think he's talking to?" So I go back, you know, and then I realize that he's drunk. So now he's coming at me and I'm trying to keep him off me, and to make a long story short, you know, the light bulb went off. He says, "Alvin, there is nothing good that's gonna come out of this." Okay? So I did what any law-abiding citizen would do when faced with a situation where you're a consumer and you're in a facility and there's an intoxicated man accosting you. Security! I went and got the security. That's right. Look, you know, in the beginning of this little episode, the 26-year-old mind realized that this is a 56-year-old body. Right? So, you know, sometimes you can bring an ass whooping and sometimes you can get one. So I didn't want to be standing up here with some patch over my head talking about trying to explain how somebody done put my eye out because they bumped into me. Anyway, so I went through, you know, got the security and went on about, you know, getting my dinner. So I guess what I'm saying is that, you know, at any given moment, man, I have to be prepared, you know, be grounded, man, you know, and make a decision, you know, sometimes, you know, to keep going. You know, make a decision to say that, you know, it's not worth it. You know, where my life is today, I'm leaving. I'm leaving the area. I'm going to be moving down to Louisiana. And then from there, we're going out west. You know, my wife was out from out west. I met her, as a matter of fact, at a convention, the World Convention of Narcotics Anonymous. Can you see this? This little pin here. And the pin says, our diversity is our strength. And this is where I met my wife. A little brief story about that. She had about 13 months clean. I had about 10 years. She had on this dress that had that you could button up from the bottom, and she hadn't buttoned many other buttons, so she had my attention. And I had a name badge on. My name badge said Alvin from Washington, D.C. Hers said Renee from Phoenix. And she walked up to me. She said, do I know you from somewhere? I looked at my name badge like a wise ass and said, no. But that's where it started. And, you know, I have four wonderful grandchildren, a set of twins, Jesse and Brian. Jalen, Isaiah, you know, they're down there and their mom's getting ready to go to Afghanistan. And, you know, I've retired, I'm moving, I'm going down to be a Papa Al, that's what they call me, down in Louisiana, and then move out west. You know, I told my wife when she moved here, 10 years ago, and I told her, I said, you know, she wanted me to move out there then, but I couldn't retire. And I told her, I said, well, I'll consider it when, you know, the children, you know, get old enough and I'm ready, you know, to retire. And that time has come. You know, that time has come. It's been wonderful being clean in the Narcotics Anonymous. You know, it hasn't been all good and it hasn't been all bad. You know, like I said, I retired. I'm a homeowner, I'm a husband, I'm a grandparent. That's the good, you know, but I've had some loss. You know, my mom and dad have made their transition. My grandmother came here for my dad's funeral, fell out of the bed. She was staying at my brother's house, hit her head, went into the hospital, had pneumonia and died 12 days later. So it's been tough at times, you know. But our liturgy says staying clean must come first. You know, no matter what happens, you know, staying clean comes first. But I guess the biggest struggle has, in terms of what has challenged my recovery and my, has been the loss of my son, Junior. Shadrach. Shadrach was killed on the streets of Washington, D.C. And We say in this program, you don't get to say who's an addict. They get to make that decision. But I just say this. I know he had a drug problem. I got him into a few treatment programs. I remember we used to send him to NA meetings. We used to give him a meeting slip. We'd have his own little meeting slip, and we'd fill it out. We made it up for him, right? You know, we tried, you know, different things. But our legislature talks about we can be beaten, you know, but we're not willing. We're not going to stop. And I remember the last time I got him into a program, he said, "Dad, I'm not ready to stop. I'm not ready to stop," you know. Back in August, about 5 years ago, he had called me from the hospital. He said that, you know, he had had an accident. Later, I found out somebody had stabbed him, and he was home. I remember taking him some medicine. It was a Sunday night. And I told him, I said, "Man, look, don't go out. Just don't go out. Just stay in, take care of yourself." But I don't know what happened. He went out that day. They found him on Florida Avenue, and he died at the Washington Hospital Center that night. And I want to tell you that, you know, still today, you know, the sadness that comes into my heart when I share this story is overwhelming. I remember a guy telling me early in recovery, he says, "If you don't surrender, you get to, you know, somebody will be telling your story." Well, Junior didn't surrender, so I get to tell the story. You know, they picked him up in the ambulance on Florida Avenue, and they took him to the hospital center, and he died alone. It wasn't the ER kind of thing where the family's face is pressed against the glass, you know, waiting, you know. He died among strangers, and because he didn't have any identification on him, we didn't find him for quite a few days. We were just looking around trying to find out where he was. But see, that's how addicts die. There's no glory and, you know, no prettiness to the death of an addict. You know, an addict dies just like that, you know. So what I do today, man, is I'm in a home group, man, with a bunch of people who are half my age. Probably most of them are about the age of my son, you know, and they don't know what they do for me, you know, how they help me, you know, and how I'm encouraged by their recovery, you know, and how, you know, by seeing their life and seeing how they're growing and starting families and starting professions that, you know, that I get uplifted every time I'm there with them. God bless you, you know. God bless all of you who have come into this program, who have stayed, you know, who, if you're the child of a parent, you know, and you're sitting out there tonight, you know, you don't know the heartache and the headache that they have when you're out there. You know, I implore you just to stay in this program. This program will work for you. I know it. I'm living proof of it. I am, you know, on Sunday morning, I'm going to come to the Sunday morning meeting. I'm going to see the Sunday speaker. I'm going to get a lot of hugs. I'm going to get a lot of kisses. And I'm going to shed a few tears. I'm going to push my daughter's name into navigational system, and it's going to pop up, Fort Polk, Louisiana. And I'm going to push the green go button. I'm going to leave this area, but I have fond memories of you. I have so much in my heart for you. You have made me the man that I am today, you know, without a doubt. But for the grace of God, you know, and you people, you know, I would have never made it. I got one more reading, and I'm going to turn out the lights. Turn out the lights. I couldn't help it, I'm sorry. Get closer. And it's from the basic text, the chapter, I Was Unique. I have found a new home in the fellowship of Narcotics Anonymous. My life again has meaning. I have found that I have but one calling in life, and that is to carry the message to the addict who still suffers. I am so grateful to God and NNA that I may do this today. I have found that you people are just like me. I am no longer better than nor less than. I feel a real love and camaraderie in the fellowship of NA. My great spiritual awakening has been that I am an ordinary addict. I am not unique. There are still those who refuse to join us and take the path we have chosen because they too feel they are unique. They may die. May God bless them too. Thank you. God bless you. And good night.